On June 18, 2009, George Hart, director of the Ocean Energy Institute, and Don Perkins, president of the Gulf of Maine Research Institute, spoke at a panel on Maine efforts to promote renewable ocean energy projects at Energy Ocean 09 at the Samoset Resort in Rockport, Maine. First, you'll hear George Hart, then there'll be some applause, followed by Don Perkins.
Good morning. You just get a taste of some of the leadership that Maine possesses, which is really exceptional. Everything you've heard about here today has taken place essentially over the last 14 months since Angus King and I got together in his living room in Brunswick. It's just unbelievable to see how quick the process here can work. And the state has been living up to its motto of I lead. I just want to quickly talk about what Angus means in technical terms when he talks about disenthralling ourselves in the past, and I want to throw a challenge out to the technical people and developers in the audience. What we're gunning for here is not just finding a green source to power our lights, our computers, and our TVs. That's only 10% of the family energy budget. We're going after the big terms, transportation and heating, because unless you do that, you don't solve the problem. And Maine is, I think, the only state in the United States, probably the only place on the planet that's gotten this message and is moving ahead. That's why we're talking about 5 to 7 gigawatts. You don't need that for the lights, TVs, and computers. So what we're trying to do is to cut total energy use by families by a factor of 3. And at the same time in doing that, by going to electricity as a source of heating and transportation, utilities will see their businesses grow by a factor of 3. It's a win-win for everyone and absolutely necessary, by the way, if we're going to hit our carbon goals in the future. How do you do it? You focus on heating and cooling in automobiles. Not electric lights is where you're paying attention. To cut the energy consumption threefold by the family, you bring in heat pumps for the homes. Driving in here this morning, you can hear them advertised on the radio. People in the state get the idea that you don't want to be burning fossil fuels to heat your home. You want to take electricity to move heat from the outside in with about a factor of 4 efficiency. In the same way that electric vehicles are very well designed to use renewable energy, they don't need the instantaneous response that lights do. They can store energy. They can give it back to the system. As part of all of this, when we're talking about building up consumption of electricity by a factor of 3, there's the absolute niche for a North American, Mexico and Canada, smart super grid. There's not time to get into all of that, but this will end the fighting between different regions over who gets to build parts of that grid, and you will also be able to balance out the intermittency, which is the plague of renewables. As I mentioned, we'll move towards zero carbon output, and we'll also kick off the fourth industrial revolution. We've got a $20 trillion pit that's been dug by Wall Street in the last few years. This is actually a path to filling that hole. The key to thinking about this is the system is not just a focus on generation, which these conferences usually do, but also pay attention to how you use that energy in a smart way that gracefully handles the intermittency and seasonality. And that means paying a lot of attention to energy storage and smart grid transmission. The big problem in all of this that as developers and technology weenies we have to pay attention to is that unless we start honestly addressing how seasonal and intermittent these sources are, we won't really grow into the future that could be ours and people won't take us seriously. It's like talking about nuclear power without ever mentioning radioactivity or the nuclear waste storage problem. And the path that we are starting to blaze in Maine actually answers that. When you go after heating and transportation, you solve that problem. What you do is use the energy in a way that matches with the seasonality of your source. We're talking about winter heating in Maine. The available power from offshore wind is 8 times greater in winter than the summer. A perfect match. We answer the seasonality issue. As I mentioned, we're getting for not electricity in the family, but heating and cooling. The other thing to shift seasonality is the use of ammonia as a fuel, which is a favorite topic of my sponsor, Matt Simmons. None of my work would have happened without his generosity and firm support. We need smart grids. They're easy to do. They can use Twitter technology to do what they have to do. We're intellectually start handcuffing ourselves by learning about a 20% penetration limit on what renewables can do. In the new world of energy I'm talking about, that's no longer a limit. Very quickly through this, because my time is about up, we've got to stop thinking about smart grids solely in terms of peak shaving and avoiding brownouts. What they can really do is solve the intermittency problem. The main benefit of transmission lines, big ones in the future, will be seeing energy balancing between intermittent sources in the country. For the offshore wind developers here, stop thinking about capacity factor. That's oftentimes a signal to you that you're not doing the job right in terms of the size of your generator. I'll just jump down to the bottom for the sake of time. I'll make the presentation available to those of you who are interested. We've got to stop these energy civil wars. We're thinking in terms of scarcity. Like, well, if we don't develop wind in the Northeast, the Midwest will get it. We need all we can get, both of renewable sources and transmission lines. I want to just jump to the very tail end of this in closing. More than I think you realize, people are behind what we're trying to do with ocean energy and other renewable sources. This is a recent survey in Maine of 600 families addressing what do you see as the key economic or financial problem facing you. Job loss is obviously a big one in the current financial climate. But number two was the price of gasoline. And this survey was taken at a time before we started this operating again. People get it, that we do have peak oil facing us in the future. Politicians can ride on that wave. The other thing, in fairness to what I'll call the Twitter generation, is that 90% of them are behind the efforts that we're doing, and eventually they will lose patience with the serial objectors who just are standing in the way of things and are putting the state and the nation at grave risk. I have the pleasure, thanks to the Island Institute, of addressing most of the residents of Manhattan Island a couple weeks ago. But people are there. They understand these technologies. They're responding to political leadership. It's all ours for the doing if we don't get going and do it on a much bigger scale than we're used to thinking about. Thank you.
Good morning. Good. Well, I'm going to speak briefly on the public outreach and the political aspects of ocean wind. Following up on George's points, I want to underscore that the coastal community here in Maine is a pragmatic community. It's a community that the ethos of which is very much tied up in fishing, which is a fuel intensive industry, and so when the price of fuel is at $4 a gallon, the issue of fuel pricing, fuel economics is very real. It's a community whose kids, whose cousins, whose nephews and nieces have served in Iraq and now Afghanistan. They understand the politics of oil security. And so it's a very pragmatic community. It's different from other parts of the country that way. I think that the first developer, commercial scale developer who comes into the state is going to set the tone for ocean wind for the next 20 or 30 years. And so my point today is just to urge you to think different when you come in here. This is a very pragmatic community if it's engaged. Anybody in the development business understands you have to deal with environmental impacts. There's a body of infinite law there. There are aesthetic and coastal landowner concerns. The Cape Wind project is a lesson in how to think about those things freshly. What I want to underscore is that along the coastal community here, you'll be dealing with very independent people and reasonable people if listened to. These are small communities. They're complex. They don't have mayors. They make their decisions, many of them, in March, in open town meetings. And so it's important to get out and deal with these communities at the individual level. It's a belly-to-belly, 5 or 10 people or 2 or 3 people around a cup of coffee process. And for those organizations that do that, you end up with a very intelligent public working with you. I I think probably the most important public to be thinking about is the lobster community. When you think about developing wind here in Maine, there are 7 lobster zones along the coast of Maine. They're democratically elected. They know the water. They're potentially an extraordinary resource, and they're interested. They are interested in ocean wind. The developer who comes in and engages that community will end up with very strong support and a thoughtful partner. The developer that ignores that community will regret having done so. And last but not least, I would just say that to anybody thinking about coming in here, to the degree that we as an institution can be any support to you thinking through these things, as I said, we're very concerned about the early developers in, because that's going to set the tone for this in the next couple decades. Thank you.